Kingston Town can't win.
Bone Crusher and our Waverley Star, stride for stride.
Cometh the hour, cometh the legend, Winks has done it.
So we're joined now by ex-champion Australian cricketer, you're also the Australian captain, Ricky Ponting. Thanks for having us, firstly.
It's nice to be here, guys. I'm happy to talk about a bit of cricket and a bit of racing, two of my great passions in life, so should be fun.
So start with your, I guess from scratch with you, Ricky, cricket, first love for you, backyard cricketer, like, you know, us all as, you know, Australians playing in the backyard. Is that where it started for you as a cricketer?
Yeah, absolutely. Growing up in the northern suburbs of Tassie, you know, on the wrong side of the tracks, and some would say in northern Launceston, it was a cricket bat in my hand in the summertime and chasing a footy around a paddock in the wintertime. And that was, you know, just the way, I guess, all of us young blokes of my age sort of grew up. So, you know, when you say was cricket my first passion, it probably wasn't, to be honest. And looking back still now, I still just regret the fact I didn't get to play one more game of Aussie Rules footy. I have those dreams now as well, like as a nearly a 50-year-old man, of just being able to play one more game of footy, because I absolutely loved Aussie Rules but cricket was the game for me. Cricket didn't choose me. I was probably a better cricketer than I would have been footballer, and here I am now, sort of retired 10 years on, and that cricket journey was a pretty amazing one, from a 14-year-old boy that left home to go to the cricket academy in Adelaide to someone that played, you know, a lot of international cricket and had some good times along the way. It was, the cricket journey was a great ride.
So I did a little bit of digging on you in your junior career. Is it right, at the age of 12, you took part in an annual Northern Tasmania junior cricket competition and you hit four centuries in that week? Is that kind of where you realised that you might be pretty good at the game, or...?
Yeah, it probably was around that time that I probably realised that I could probably have a bit of fun playing cricket. That was what we used to have then. That was a holiday, school holiday period thing. So every club played against each other for the every day of the week. So Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, you played a different club. And I missed out I think I got 50 odd in the first game, and then the last four days got 400s in a row. So, and then the next week played up the next week in the under 16s and got 200s the next week in the under 16s. So, and yeah, all those stories, you know, they tie back. I actually got my first sponsorship deal out of that week. Signed on with Kookaburra at the age of 13, pretty much, and was with them to the end when I finished at 38. So, lots of good things started from that one week that you talk about there.
I've got one just on Kookaburra. I used to have a Kookaburra kahuna, just obviously following yourself. Can you take us through the journey of joining Kookaburra, and how much input did you have into the bats themselves?
Yeah, well, even with that, I'd like to think of myself as quite a loyal person. Like any of those sponsors that I had that were willing to sort of show some faith in me as a youngster, I made sure I saw the journey through with them right to the end. And Kookaburra is a great example. You know, I think I was with them for 26, 27 years or something. So, and I must admit, my first ever sponsorship deal with Kookaburra was one bat, one pair of gloves, one pair of pads, a thigh pad, and a kit bag, and that was all it was. And to the end, when I'm finished, when you're probably going through 20 or 30 or 40 bats a year and a couple of hundred pairs of gloves and that sort of stuff. So things changed quite dramatically and drastically. Did I have a bit to do? Yeah, I think I had a bit to do with the development of all the equipment, not just the bats, but little things that I thought they could improve on, pads or gloves or whatever. There was always that input from me back to Kookaburra, and they were always asking my advice as well on what they should do. You know, a lot of my gear at the end was all custom made anyway. It wasn't, you know, it's the regulation stuff. There was some things that I used to do with my gloves that most other players didn't like. You know, I got really small hands, so they were like almost like youth size gloves that I was wearing, and a lot of the extra padding in the gloves at that stage, I didn't like the feel of the extra padding. So I was probably using gloves at the end that were sort of 10 years past their date, but that was what I liked and what I was comfortable with. So, and no squash, maybe at training, but I wasn't gutsy enough to take it out in a World Cup final first up and use it there.
Jumping ahead to your debut test for Australia, just a bit of a two-part question. What was it like pulling on that baggy green for the first time? And secondly, 96 test debut, not a bad start. And I think there was a bit of a controversial decision with you going out that day.
Yeah, where was the DRS back then? I needed the DRS. There's a bit of a backstory as well to that, to my first test. Tasmania were playing Sri Lanka in a tour game. Obviously, that was the test series that was happening, was Australia-Sri Lanka. And I was out in the middle batting, and I was 100 and something not out. And I looked up into the stand at one of my home grounds in Lyon. I looked up into the stand. My mum was sitting in the stand, and it was really unusual for mum to come and watch, because I actually thought she was a bit of a jinx on me, so I never used to let her come. It was a big game. Mum's just stay at home, give me the best chance of getting some runs. And I looked up, and I saw her in the stand. I thought, what? Something's not right. Anyway, I walked off at the tea break, and she grabbed me at the gate and gave me a big hug and said, I just found out you're playing next week in Perth. You're in the test team. So she knew before I did. And then that whole week was pretty surreal, to be honest. Mum and dad and my grandmother all flew over for it. And I remember the night before the game, I took all the stickers off my bat, sanded my bats down, put all new stickers on, put all new grips on, which is pretty unusual for someone to play their first test match. But, yeah, and then I finally get out there. I think we made about 600, I reckon. I waited forever to go and bat, and I finally got a chance and was facing Murali first ball, and who I'd faced the week before in Lonnie, and played well. And I remember standing at the crease, about to face my first ball in Test cricket, and I was saying to myself over and over in my head, whatever you do, don't run down the wicket, don't run down the wicket, don't run down the wicket first ball. Ran down the wicket first ball, got a little outside edge on one that landed just short of first slip and rolled into the fence for four to get off the mark. So nervous times, but great times as well.
And your nickname, you know, the Australian Test cricketers, they've all got some, you know, some famous and iconic nicknames. Yours, Punter. I think it's a nice synergy here with this podcast you're on. How did you come about that nickname, or who gave you that nickname, and how did that come about, and why was it Punter?
Yeah, well, I said I moved across to the Cricket Academy in Adelaide. I'd found out I was going as a 14-year-old and went the next winter as a 15-year-old kid from Launceston. I had a kit bag, a pair of track pants, a couple of T-shirts and a hoodie was about all I had. And we went to the Cricket Academy. Everything was put on for us. Our meals and laundry and everything was paid for. So our monthly allowance at that time was $40 a month was what we got paid to live there. So just doing the maths in my own head, I was thinking, I've got to find a way to turn this $40 into a little bit more. Otherwise, I'm not going to get through here. And so I'd sneak down to the local TAB on a Monday night and a Tuesday afternoon and then a Thursday night, which coincided with the same time that the Tasmanian Greyhounds are racing, and I'd try and turn that $40 into a little bit more with sort of $1 and $2 bets, which is all I could afford back then. And at the same time, Warnie, God bless him, had came over to spend some time with us at the academy before. He'd just been picked on his first tour with Australia to Sri Lanka, so he needed to get some training done. As you can probably understand with Warnie, pre-season, he needed to get some training done. So he spent a bit of time with us. He worked out what I was doing, getting down to the tab, he gave me my nickname. And it's, you know, stuck with me ever since. And people probably know me more now by that than they do by my proper name. So thanks, Warnie.
Something we can all relate to.
Yeah.
Captaining the Australian cricket team, it's one of the highest responsibilities an Australian can have. What were some of the highs and lows, and what were some of the most memorable moments?
Yeah, fortunately, you know, the teams that I played in and even the teams that I captained, we had, you know, good runs of sustained success, I guess. I mean, and so, you know, you think about, or even when I captained the 2003 World Cup team that, you know, went through undefeated, captained the next one, 2007, we went through that World Cup undefeated once again. Lots of great highlights there. Won the 2006-07 Ashes series 5-0 here in Australia, but that goes, wind the clock back 12 months, and that probably comes to the low light of my career as well, which was losing the 05 Ashes in England as captain. You know, we'd gone there as the number one ranked team in the world, and for, you know, a few different reasons, we didn't put our best cricket on the park for long enough through that series. Ended up being one of the all-time great test series, to be honest. You know, came down to late on day five at the Oval with us searching for a win, and unfortunately bad light stopped play a little bit early and sort of didn't give us the chance to chase the win that we needed to retain the Ashes. But I guess that was the low point, I guess, in my career, because we were expected to win, because we had a champion team, and to actually have to stand in the middle of the Oval and hand over the Ashes to Michael Vaughan and his team was a pretty tough thing to do. But that didn't happen so often, thankfully. So we had some great times along the way.
And that, you know, that amazing run you had as the Invincibles, the test team there, what was it like kind of leading that group of men? When did you know that, I guess, they were that's something special? And did you all motivate each other to be better? Like, just being around each other each day, did it motivate you and kind of inspire you each to be better at what you do?
Yeah, I think so. So that was, you know, probably Steve Waugh's team rolling over into my team, wasn't it? That test team under Steve Waugh had won 16 consecutive tests, and then there was a little bit of a break in the middle, and then I took over and we also did the same thing. We won 16 consecutive test matches as well, which, you know, it's a pretty remarkable thing to do. It's never been done before, and two Australian teams have done it with only, you know, a couple of years separation between them. So, you know, did we motivate ourselves? There's no doubt. You know, we pretty much coached ourselves as well. Not saying we didn't have coaches. We had great coaches around. But when you spend that much time with each other and you know each other the way that you do, and I've said this forever, I think in any sport, your teammates are your best coaches, because you're out there in the heat of battle and you're learning during the game and as things are unfolding. And I guess in a test match, when you're batting with one person, you've got a lot of time together to talk your way through and learn from each other and you know, combine as a partnership to hopefully win games of cricket for your team. So, yeah, I mean, looking back now, and I won't say you take it for granted ever, but you don't think much about it when it's unfolding. You know, you're just part of a team and you're winning games and you're having a great time. But it's when you're retired and you sit back and think, my God, that was just an incredible time in all of our lives, you know. And some of the things you say there, that, I mean, the records of what was achieved through that period pretty much speak for themselves. I mean, the one thing that's probably not spoken about enough is from the midway point of the 99 World Cup until the midway point of the 2011 World Cup, Australia didn't lose one single World Cup game, which, that's, you know, you're playing a lot of good teams there with finals in mixed in the middle of them. And it must be close on 40 games, World Cup games, without losing one. So, yeah, it's a pretty amazing run.
And just that team, too, obviously made up with a lot of different personalities. Just any, I guess, some stories around, Pidge, Glenn McGrath was, you know, he was the bit of the funny one in the team, and kind of,
I'm not sure about the funny one. He was the menace.
He was the menace.
He's a country boy from Narrabri. He's never going to be that funny.
What was it like? You know, you had personalities like, yeah, your Warnies, your Gillies, yourself. What was it like in the locker room and like a day to day, you know, it's a five day test. What was it like over those 5 days with some of those personalities?
No, look, as I said, once again, unbelievable, incredible to think back, you know, like the biggest part. I knew taking over the captaincy, the biggest challenge that I was going to have was to understand everyone, understand everyone's personalities. And, you know, how do I speak to Michael Bevan on one hand? How do I speak to Andrew Simons on the next? You know, how do I speak to Justin Langer 1 minute and Glenn McGrath the next? Because all of them are such different people. But I knew if I was going to be a good captain that I had to work it out and work it out pretty quickly. And I think I did a reasonable job with that. You know, and the only way I could do that is spend time with them and get to know more about them, learn about them as cricketers, but more importantly, learn about them from what motivates them off the field as well. So that's what I tried to do. And as I say, you come away with lifelong friends as a result of that time you spend together. Cricket's a pretty unique game. You know, when you're playing in the Australian cricket team, you're spending, you know, 11 months of every year together, for some of us for 10, 12 years of our lives. So you experience some incredible things, the highs and lows of cricket and of personal life. And then when your career's over, which is what we've learnt, you know, the last few months with what's happened with some of our mates, you go to spending all this time together, to going back to your home state and your own family and your own life, and these guys you spent so much time with, you don't see anymore. So I've taken it upon myself this year to make sure we get back together, start a bit of a reunion type thing, and I'm hosting the boys this weekend actually in Melbourne, so it might be a big one.
And you're hitting the golf course, you're a handy golfer. How is your golf game at the moment?
I haven't played for a month actually. I played in a big event in New York about a month ago, and then came back from there, had a nothing to do with the golf, I don't think, but I had a trapped nerve in my lower back, which meant I couldn't walk, basically. So I wasn't game to even try and swing a golf club, but I hit some the other day, so hopefully I'll be back on course again tomorrow.
And probably just the last question before we do get into some of the racing. You've now transitioned into the cricket media. Was that always going to be the path for you? When did you sort of realise in your career that that's what you wanted to do?
No, if you'd have seen me stand in front of a camera as about an 18 or 19-year-old, you wouldn't have thought I'd be working in the media at any stage in my career. And to be honest, even when I was playing, I didn't really have much of an idea or a picture of what life looked like, you know, post-cricket. I was always going to be involved somewhere, but I probably thought I'd be a coach and get into coaching before I got into the media side of things. But pretty much first year out, I think I had one summer off, and then was lucky enough to get a job at Channel 10 then, doing the big batches, which is where it started. And now with Channel 7 calling 5 tests this summer and 15 or 20 big bash games. So things have changed quickly, and I love it. I love every minute of it, to be honest. You know, a bit the same. The environment around a commentary team is a bit the same as the environment around a cricket team. That's the way we try to do things at Channel 7 anyway. And it's, you know, the last 5 or 6 years have been a a blast. And that, and it's also allowed me to travel to different countries and do it as well. You know, the Ashes is on in England middle of next year. I'll hopefully be over there doing that with one of the networks over there, which will be awesome. So keeps me close to the game. And it actually makes – so the coaching I do makes commentary easier, and the commentary I do actually makes my coaching easier. So the balance I've got in my life right now is really good.
Racing or horse racing? Yeah, you're obviously a big fan. Do you know where you're kind of your love or your interest in racing started?
Very easy to work that out. Yeah, my dad was a – I've ended up with a nickname punter, but it should have been him. Let's put it that way. No, like as a kid growing up, whether it's Friday night or Saturday afternoon, you know, the radio was always on. I can still actually, to this day, memorise my dad's telephone account number, which – 1107 GCPO. There you go. I can still remember it, and that'd honestly be 30. That'd be 40 years ago when I was sitting there listening to Dad have a bet on the Friday night races here at Moonee Valley. So, that's no doubt where it started. You know, racing was in our family. Dad and my grandfather not horse racing, but had raced greyhounds. So the betting punting side of things was there. So, yeah, I was never going to avoid it, I don't think, in the family that I grew up in.
I don't think you earned the nickname punter without being decent at the caper. Can you tell us what type of punter you are? Are you a straight win, or you delve into the exotics, the quaddies?
Yeah, no, I've expanded and broadened my horizons gambling-wise. Well, as we all have now, with the amount of options you've got available to have now, even in one particular race, you know. Whoever thought 5 years ago you'd be betting in race? That's amazing. But look, I reckon 10 years ago, no, not even 10 years ago, 5 years ago, I was very much just almost an out-and-out win bet only, very few each-way bets. But I think, you know, the social side of racing now, you know, going to the track with your friends or going to the pub with your friends and all getting together, sitting down and having a quaddie together, you know, the social side of it is as big a part of it, I think, as anything else. You know, to have a beer or a wine and a great meal at the track and you know, have a quaddie on together is what I look forward to most Saturdays when I'm at home.
So do I. You spoke about being on the road a lot in your job as a cricketer. Did you manage to get to any international race courses? Did you manage to have much downtime to be able to get to any race courses while you're overseas? And anyone that kind of, you know, did you get to the Ascots or over to, you know, to Europe to go to a race day there?
No, I never been to Ascot yet. And the first thing that came to mind when you said that was I played a lot with Mark Waugh. And Mark, if I like a bet, then there's someone that likes a bet. Obviously, you know, a very successful trainer, or married to a very successful trainer now in her own right, Kim. We went actually to the Barbados Cup, if you can imagine. So not the shortest jockeys going around, the Bayesians, they're 6'4" jockeys riding these horses around at the Barbados Cup. We've got some great photos actually of him and I standing in the grandstand at the Barbados Cup. I've been to the races in Mauritius. It's another interesting place to have gone to the races. Durban, South Africa, been to the races there. Obviously New Zealand, been to the the Auckland Cup. Is that their big race, the Auckland Cup, I reckon? I've been to that when we're over there on a cricket tour, actually, that actually worked in at the same time. I don't think I've been to any races in the UK anywhere, to be honest. Normally must be out of racing season when we're there for the Ashes, must be out of their sort of peak racing season time, but I guess we've been lucky enough to travel a fair bit and get to a few different venues around the world.
Do you have a most memorable day on the racetrack, or maybe a win that you'll never forget?
Punting wise would have been a few years ago when Vaughan de Clare won the Melbourne Cup. I'm good friends with Danny, and when he'd sent the horse to Brisbane, I remember he won a race in Brisbane. I remember I got a message from him saying, "Mate, I think I've got a horse here that can win the Melbourne Cup," and it wasn't even in yet. I remember it got balloted in. It was one of the last reserves in only a couple of days before the race. I think it was 150-1 I was on the team bus in the UK. I was coaching with the Aussie team. It was either it might have been the 50 over World Cup. When we first put the bet on, and I was sitting next to David Warner, and I said, "Oh, just got this message. Let's have a look at what this thing's paying. We better have a little bet." And happened to be at the track on the day that it won, and to this day, still don't know how it did win, to be honest. We thought we'd done our money there, but I guess as far as the punt and memorable days, that'd be one that will be right up there.
And almost wins. You did have a bit of a off-camera story about here one night.
Yeah, it was here. Yeah, yeah, heartbreaking story actually. And this story amongst that group of friends that I'm talking about only came up again about a week ago. So my wife and all her friends, I think there were eight of them, It was my wife's 40th birthday, and they were sitting around at lunch, and Nina O'Brien was with the girls, and she said, "Oh, for Rihanna's birthday, why don't we all get together? And well, Danny's just bought a horse at the sales. Why don't we go in this this filly together?" So they all did, went in it then. They had a great run with it, and won a few races. Just been sold, actually, to racing up in Queensland now. But one night here, we'd all come, all the girls that invited the husbands here were sitting upstairs having, you know, enjoying a meal. And I thought, I've got to try and find a way here to have her as an anchor in a last leg of some sort of multi. So I got some greyhound tips from a friend of mine at Geelong on the same night, on a Friday night. All four of those had won, and the horse was called Need New Friends. She was the last leg of a five-leg multi, which we had going for a lot of money. We'd gone down on the winning post down the track with Danny, who was with us. Anyway, head bobber across the line.
But it's Need New Friends and Gimme the Goss, who's kicking back on the inside. Gimme the Goss and Need New Friends, and a head bobbing finish, and it can go either way.
She goes across the line, and Danny's throwing his arms in the air, and yeah, she's won, she's got there. So we're doing handstands along the rail down there, and then they put the photo up, and she's literally got beat by a pimple. She was in front before the post and in front past the post, but as we found out, they don't pay for that. They only pay for where they are when they're on the post. So, yeah, but awesome night out. Just could have ended up a lot better.
You touched on off camera that you currently own two race horses. Do you want to just touch on who those two are? And also, the extended question is some of the other horses you've owned in your time.
Yeah, look, I haven't had a lot of horses, to be honest. I've been in six or eight, maybe a few of those with Kim and Mark. As I said, when we're playing together, Mark would always tap me on the shoulder. Oh, we've got a share in this. We've got a free share. Not free. We've got a spare share in this. What do you reckon about coming in? The two I've got now, one we brought out for the carnivals. It must be 3 or 4 years ago now, a German stayer that had won some nice races over there, a horse called Django Freeman. We haven't had much luck with him out here. He's only had probably half a dozen starts. Too bad. Now, Bone Chip, his first prep out here, which was on the eve of what was going to be his first start in Australia. So missed the whole carnival. And then a ligament, last one, which has put him back sort of 12 or 18 months. He's back in work now. We'll trial, I think. No, he actually had a trial earlier this week. Pulled up really well from that, so hopefully he's back on track soon. And we've got an unraced one with Danny called Medina, that a pariah, well, he was a colt, pariah gelding now, that's also had a trial up the straight on Monday or Tuesday morning, can't remember when it was. Pulled up a little bit sore from that, so he might have a few more weeks out again now, which would be a bit frustrating because he was just about ready to go. So they're the only two that I've got. And as I said, Brianna, with her involvement in that Need New Friends, they've sold that off to Queensland. I think she'll be a mare before long, I think.
And our signature race, the Ladbrokes Cox Plate. Do you have a fond memory of the race, or you know your thoughts and feelings on our feature race?
Yeah, I think it's probably the most excited I get for the carnival, to be honest. Cox Plate Day. Well, a lot of people probably say the same thing. I mean, this when you actually get a chance to come to the track here and witness what it's like, and with those few years in a row there where Winx was coming and doing what she was doing, I mean, I can't imagine there's a better atmosphere anywhere in the world when there's a horse like that going around and you've got the amphitheatre that's created outside here. It's pretty special. So, all right, there's a couple that stand out most for me. And it was interesting with Bossy here with us today. So You Think's first one for me was that's one that really stands out in my mind. Because I remember, and I was talking to him about it today, that the lead up that week after the barrier draw and where he'd drawn out in the car park, what are they going to do? How are they going to ride it? Like, ping, straight to the front, ride it like the best horse, and they'd nothing got even close to it.
So You Think led by two lengths. He shook off Manhattan Rain, who he got to an El Segundo charging home, but it's all over. So You Think is going to go all the way. He's racing clear, and So You Think has bolted in the Cox Plate. Manhattan Rain ran second. The three-year-old Quinella.
That was one that I really remember, and the other one I was saying, with knowing Danny now like I do, thinking back to what sort of training effort and feat that is to get a maiden to win a Cox Plate, Seamus Award to win a Cox Plate, I think it's never happened again, has it? Never, wasn't not before and not after.
It's a done deal, was boxing on, but Seamus Award still led by a length and a half, and he shook off Fiorente. Happy Trails is coming down the outside, and Fortella's coming. Seamus Award in front. Happy Trails having the last lunge at him. He dives, misses. Seamus Award, the maiden, has won it.
So that's a pretty amazing achievement. And as it goes, actually, that Seamus Award was the sire of that horse that I was talking about there, that Need New Friends that the girls brought. So Some pretty fond memories there. And then you throw Makybe Diva and Winx in for, what was she, four?
Four.
Yeah, it's amazing. And let's hope that another animal like her comes around again, and all the memories and history that's being created here can happen again, because it'd be pretty special if it did.
Absolutely.
We know there's a fierce rivalry between Australia and England, both in cricket, and now a little bit with the horses. We've had Matt Chapman come out here in 2018 and kind of talk down Winx a little bit, and in recent times we've had a jockey, Ocean Murphy, do the same. What are your thoughts on that rivalry between England kind of talking down our horses?
They can't let it go, can they? they just can't accept it, and they can't let it go. What did Nature Strip do a couple of weeks ago? That was pretty impressive.
Pretty good.
Yeah, pretty good. Black Caviar won on two legs over there. I would have loved to have seen what Winx would have done to him. Because if there's been a bit, well, I mean, there probably has been better horses, but I haven't seen one in the flesh like I have with her. You know, some of the things that have happened in the UK and America with some of the great horses they've had and winning margins and things like that, I mean, you can imagine what she would have done to some fields if they wanted to with Winx. You know, she could have won by as far as she wanted to more often than not. And what I would have actually loved to see with her is actually just put her around in a Melbourne Cup and see what she would have. I reckon she would have handled that quite well as well, just being the sort of animal that she was. So, no, they can't let it go. They can't let it go. I know they've had some success with horses they brought out here over for our carnivals and stuff, but that rivalry will always be there. It doesn't matter if it's cricket, racing, netball, whatever it is, they won't let it go.
And this is the, I guess, time of year where the good horses start hitting the tracks again. Do you have a favourite horse at the moment, or someone you're looking really forward to watching this spring?
I'm interested in, well, I'll keep going back to Danny. I'm interested in Danny's team, actually, for the spring, with a lot of the Western Australians that he's got, the Peters horses that he's got. I understand a few of them trialled really well during the week, showmanship being one, I think, that I'll be keeping a close eye on the next couple of weeks. And even, I've been actually thinking about Cox Plate even. You know, you look at Zaki, and I'm interested to see Animo come back. What's he now, four-year-old? Interested to see how he can do. I watched another awesome trial the other day. I saw a non-conformist trial the other day as well, which went Django was in its trial, actually. Django got left behind a little bit late in that, but that horse went exceptionally well. So, there's enough now. The good ones are coming out, which makes you want to get to the track more, doesn't it? When the better horses start coming back out, it's this time of year, right time of year again. You either get to the track or you get your mates and go to the pub and sit back and watch some high quality racing.
Absolutely. And you're on, you mentioned Animo before. Obviously, last year's race was, you know, such a famous one with him in state of rest. Don't want to hopefully bring up any bad memories, but were you on Animo last year, and what do you think of that decision at the end and how that all unfolded?
No, I wasn't on Animo last year. Interestingly, my manager had sent me about a week before telling me that I had to be on state of rest in that race, and I still don't know how it won, to be honest, but pretty good, tough win, wasn't it? And to be honest, I'm not sure if I had a bet in the race even, which would have been unusual if I didn't, but I don't think I got the price that my manager got for state of rest, let's put it that way.
Well, Ricky, I think that's all our questions, so it's been brilliant meeting you firstly, and thanks for your time.
Looking forward to seeing you out here during the carnival at some stage, boys.
Thanks, Bunter.
Thanks. Cheers.
Cheers.
Top.